And our guest tonight, Dr. Greg Little, some incredible information about Atlantis. And now the shocking stuff is right around the corner. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Greg, let's talk a little bit about the Hall of Records at Bimini, because that's the big story, I think, of all. You've investigated it, and you don't think it was directly in some kind of hall or casing. You think that it was already possibly found?
You're talking about the Hall of Records at Bimini?
Yes.
Some
boat cargo or something?
This gets complicated.
Is shocking if it's true.
Well, it would be. I mean, there's a marble, what looks like a marble temple we did find. We were actually led to it by two Bahamians, Krista and Ashley Brown. They had been taken there some years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, by somebody.
How deep?
It's exactly 28 feet.
Okay.
It's loads of fish in the area. There are sharks in the area because you got all this bottom stuff, and then the fish just stay around it. What we could see initially were only 4 or 5 stone slabs. It was kind of a mound. Now, we have our own side scan sonar, and so we started by using the side scan sonar in this area, and what we found was that this is a really huge area, and there's all kinds of blocks and long beams and things under the sand. But we zeroed in this one area, and it was just dark stone, and it didn't look like much of anything. So we had on the boat at that time what's called a hookah, and a hookah. It is a breathing apparatus, not a thing you smoke illegal substances with, but it's a breathing apparatus.
That's a hookah as well, isn't it?
Yes, that's a hookah as well. Yeah. It certainly is. that would be difficult to breathe underwater with.
Yes,
there's a generator, a compressor and a generator on the boat, which then sends air down it, so you can stay at relatively shallow depths pretty much indefinitely and work. But we cleaned off, we focused on a couple of these stones that were black and sort of cleaned them off. The Bahamians removed some big pieces from them, and lo and behold, here is this apex or parapet of a building. And we have an underwater video that we use. It's a remote underwater video that then goes to the boat, and we kind of went all over with the area and cleaned things off. The Bahamian broke off a little piece from this parapet and brought it to the surface, and then he took pieces from maybe 10 different pieces of these stone, and this is before we knew what they were, brought them to the surface, and we were astonished. It is beautiful white marble. The inside of these things, just in the sunlight, it looked like quartz crystal. So this is the last thing that we actually found at Bimini. It has not turned out to be probably the most important thing, but it was certainly the most incredible. And we're sitting on the boat, and I'm saying, we've shut everything off, and we're trying to decide, what do we do? Because nobody's going to believe this. That this is exactly what everyone has been looking for, a temple that is under the water, most of it buried under what Casey called the slime of ages. It's on like this big mound, and it just fit the description perfectly. It's actually 7 miles north of Bimini.
But you have said in the past that you think it could be a trick.
Yes, that's
Why?
What I've said now. Because
is this the skeptic part of you now?
No. Some of my books are about Carl Jung, and actually the first book I ever wrote was in '82, and it uses the word synchronicity in the title, and it talks about Carl Jung's concept of a trickster. And a trickster, a trickster is something that Jung believed existed, but it also we do it to ourselves. And so we found this other stuff at Bimini, which we're going to get to, which is the 10,000 BC shoreline and these what appear to be building foundations. At the time, we didn't know it because we didn't have our photos yet. But then we found this temple, and we sat there and said, okay, either one of two things has happened. Either we have found a temple that looks like a Greek temple, which was built right here and collapsed, and then when the sea levels rose, it went under the water, which is exactly what Casey said the temple concealing the Hall of Records is, mm-hmm. Or there was some sort of a ship a long time ago. It can't be a metal ship because there were no remains of a ship there. A ship just happened to have the remains of a temple right on it And for some reason, it sailed there and it sank right there, and we found the remains of the ship, which seemed just as unlikely. Both of those seemed unlikely, but it was the last thing we found. My wife and I really were ready to move on to really search the Great Bahama Bank, which we'd already begun. We'd found so many things in the Bahama Bank. We were really excited about it, and we didn't want to go back to Bimini. We were through with it. And I said, this just feels like it's a trick.
Why would they do this to you?
Well,
or to anybody?
Well, no person did it. It's not that a person did it. It's kind of like the universe does it. And it's not a trick. I see it as a test. The trickster doesn't exist, the trick is per se. It's like a test. That's what it is. So what we did, as soon as we got back to the States, well, the first thing we did was spend 2 days in the University of Florida Library trying to find out about something else we found at Andros, which will probably be the last thing we talk about in this show, a wall that we found there, which is inexplicable. But we started digging in to try and find out where, if anybody else has ever reported this, about this, these marble ruins. Now, we have read repeatedly reports about marble being all around Bimini. Well, there's marble columns that have been found at the inlet at Bimini. That is true.
And where would the marble come from during that time period?
The marble, nobody knows. That's the best I can tell you. No, who knows? I don't know. I can tell you we did find a report in a very obscure book where this guy by the name of Richard Wingate, who was a kind of a treasure hunter explorer in the 60s and 70s, and in 1970 he talked about going to this site 7 miles north of Bimini, and he found this massive area, and he found marble, and he found what sounded exactly like this parapet.
Isn't most marble now come from Italy? Places like that?
It probably is Italian or Greek marble. It probably is. What Richard Wingate did, they brought a boat in. They actually destroyed the boat doing this, and they rigged up a way to blow all the prop wash down to get rid of the sand. And he said that they blew three layers of marble, that there were huge slabs of marble stacked on top of each other, various pieces, that went down many, many feet, and there were at least three layers there, and it was in a massive area. But he said there were some boat ribs under the bottom, and that was enough for me. I just decided that even if, no matter what it is, at that point, since there's a report out there that says there's boat ribs under it, it just doesn't matter what it is now. Skeptics would never accept it. No one would accept it
right.
as anything but boat remains.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
That's where we're at with that. But it's pretty incredible. I have to admit, it's one of the most phenomenal things I've ever seen underwater.
And it happens to be in that location.
It's right there, and we'd be glad to give anybody the precise GPS to go there and have a look at it.
Not very deep water, 28 feet.
28 feet, and the water is generally crystal clear. I mean, you can look down and see it from the surface.
Farther out in the ocean, the Atlantic, it gets really deep.
The deeper the water gets, the more murky it seems to get. And that's the problem with this second thing at Bimini that we found, which is probably archaeologically the really big news. And it's the news that mainstream archaeologists will just hate and deny, although they really can't deny. There's nothing to deny, really. Back in November of 2006, which wasn't that long ago, Bill Donato did a massive side-scan sonar project off of Bimini in an area that's, 5, 6, 7 square miles. And it's about 5, 6 miles off of Bimini toward Florida. And it's toward the Gulf Stream. It's an area where it's far deeper. And what he found was this line of very regular rectangles.
Was this the Bimini Road?
No, the Bimini Road's actually very close to Bimini itself. We have already proven the Bimini Road is a harbor. The only people that don't accept it are some of the hardened skeptics who themselves appear to be using psychic archaeology to say that it's not a harbor.
Do you believe, though, the Bimini Road still was part of Atlantis?
I believe the Bimini Road was part of a maritime culture that was active in 4,000 B.C. or 6,000 years ago.
Okay.
There's a structure at Andros that was the exact same thing, and there's probably one at Kaysal Bank that probably dates to the same time. They're all the same depth, but it was a harbor. There's no doubt about
it. Isn't it amazing how mankind, though, completely... They're like ants. They rebuild after destroyed. They rebuild.
We do that all the time.
Yep.
Absolutely. Well, Donato found these structures on his side scan sonar, rectangles, very regular, very uniform, in pretty much a straight line.
And this is Andros now?
Well, no, this is off of Bimini.
Off of Bimini.
We haven't moved down to the bank yet to Andros.
All right.
Because this is big. This is big news. This is pretty amazing. At the 100-foot depth, which would have been where the sea levels were in 10,000 B.C., he found all these rectangles. Well, they tried while he was there to dive to it, but at 100 feet near the Gulf Stream, the water movements can just be horrible on the bottom, and the water can be murky, and they didn't really have a way to mark the location. They had the GPS, but the boat moves around. So Bill sent us his GPS location and the main side scan image. So when we went out with our own GPS and refound his rectangles in about 5 minutes. And then we managed to drop buoys right in, these weighted lead buoys, directly into these rectangular forms. And actually, our anchor actually fell right into a large one. And then, excuse me, Krista and Esley Brown, both of whom are master divers, went down, and it was very rough for them.
They got all the way down, though?
Oh, yeah. They went down to them, inside of them, took quite a few photos. When they came back, they said it's stone, and there's a tremendous amount of coral. But they didn't know what else to say, so they gave us the photos. And they said, you just have to look at them, but they didn't know what to say. But they don't know much about archaeology. They're great divers, and they're wonderful guides. But when we then looked at the photos and processed them at 100 feet, what we saw are stones stacked on top of stones, like in building foundations.
Could not be caused naturally.
No, not this. And it's coral encrusted, but these are definitely not natural formations, nor are stones going to fall from a boat and go down 100 feet and fall on top of each other into rectangular patterns in a line that goes over a mile, and you probably have 20, 30, 40 of these rectangles down there.
So there's no question in my mind that there were ancient structures here. Something happened. They sank, sea levels rose, something dramatic happened. What makes you think, though, Greg, that we're talking about Atlantis?
Well, that's what Casey said it was. 10,000 B.C., Plato said Atlantis existed. 10,000 B.C., Casey said Atlantis existed.
How did Plato know?
Well, who knows? Plato's story goes way, way back. If you really want to know, I can tell you about 10 seconds. He wrote it in 355 B.C., but he said he heard the story from his great-grandfather, Critias, and Critias was told the same story by his grandfather, who was also called Critias, who heard it from his father, Dropides, and Dropides heard it from Solon, and Solon heard it from the priests at Sais in Egypt. That is the story. That's how Plato knew. But Plato said that they carefully passed it along by word of mouth, and he wrote it down, he said, word for word as he remembered it.
That is an amazing story. Yeah, now, let's talk a little bit about Andros, and then when we make the corner turn here at the half, I want to talk with you, Greg, about the technology you think might have been at Atlantis. But tell me about Andros.
Andros Island is about 100 miles beyond Bimini. It is the largest of the Bahama Islands. It's 50 miles from Nassau and the resort of Atlantis. It's probably the least visited and least inhabited of all the Bahama Islands. Western Andros is totally uninhabited. Nobody goes there. Nobody visits there. You never see any planes. You never see any boats. Nothing.
Remote.
It's very remote, and it's very difficult to get to. You can't just get a boat over there. You can walk, and I've said this before, and it's true, If you get on Western Andros, just about anywhere, it's 104 miles long. You can walk approximately 10 miles into the ocean, and you're not over your head. That is how shallow it is.
Yeah.
And that is the Bahama Bank. But it goes out about 60 miles to 70 miles from there. So we've been exploring a 50-mile area. We've started in, off of North Andros, an area about 10 miles by 50 miles, and we've started exploring by air. And we identified, well, we started identifying this past time, 31 bizarre underwater formations on the Great Bahama Bank. They look like, best way to describe them is two ways, either a ship, a huge ship that's 500 feet long, or they look like eyeballs.
Eyeballs?
With a white spot in the center. You always find something in that white spot, and the rest of the formation is made out of, it's really turtle grass. Most people would call it seaweed, but it's dense turtle grass that forms around whatever the white spot begins with.
Can you see it really well from above?
You can see, these things are stunning from above, just stunning. Charles Berlitz published a lot of photos of these in his series of books in the 1970s, but they never visited a single one. Part of the problem is, in the 70s, you know, you could fly out there and see it and photograph it, but you couldn't get to it in a boat because you had no GPS.
That's right.
They had no way of finding it. And these spots are all over the place, but they're incredible. They're 500-600 feet long. Now, in the middle of one that we identified and were just fascinated with, right in the middle, and actually that's on one of our websites, you can actually see the plane in the white spot. I'm not going to say which one it is, but if you look at the website, if people click on and look at some of these pictures of what's on the on the Great Bahama Bank, they can see this. We found a plane upside down in one. We actually removed one of the landing gears. There's a photo of me holding it. We found a very old remains of a wooden ship in one of these. We found the ballast stones of the wooden ship in a nice little oval in the middle of the white spot. There were all kinds of pieces of wood there. We're in the process of carbon dating a piece of the wood right now. We found dumped bombs, unexploded bombs, lots of gas canisters.
Incredible.
Appliances. We found in one of the most interesting formations that my wife called the ball and tee, because it looks like a huge golf tee with a ball on top and a ball next to it. The ball next to it had a boat trailer in it with two tires, giant tires. But the rest of the tee formation was a stone formation. Just very bizarre. It was made out of, they looked like stone blocks a little similar to those at the Bimini Road, but they weren't as big. So about 25% of these 31 formations that we visited, that's all we had time to visit in these trips, about 25% of them were stone of some kind, very odd.
And how old do you think they might have been?
I don't know, George. We are looking for something really definitive. And so what we did, we had to move really quickly from one to another because there's so many of them. And these are 50 miles off of land. We're not in a big boat. We have to leave Andros. And you have to be in a boat that can go through a foot of water. You can't. The boat has to have a draft of 1 foot. And you have to do it in daylight because there's reefs all over the place. It's the only way to get in and out.
I'm trying to imagine, Greg, what it's like for the people who were there during that time period when, let's say, the comet came in and incinerated them, or something else, and it might have been a slow rise of sea level that slowly eroded their countryside.
Yeah.
It must have been horrible for them.
It would have been terrifying. The best thing about the comet is it would have been over quickly.
Yeah, very fast. Stay with us. I want to talk about the technology you believe might have been at Atlantis when we come back, and then we'll open up the phone lines at the top of the hour. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for you. But I'll be back in a moment. We'll talk about some of the high technology that Greg Little believes Atlantis might have had. Greg, did Edgar Cayce talk about the kind of technology that the Atlanteans had?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he spent a lot of those 700 readings talked about that.
Let's go through some of it. Give us the highlights.
Well, the highlights are he talked about they had great ability with metallurgy. They had all kinds of metals they used. They had lighter than aircraft. mainly hot air. It's like hot dirigibles, but they seem to be hot air, and they were propelled by hot air, similar to this this Firestone. The Firestone somehow was used to generate energy to propel this lighter-than-air craft. But he said they also had underwater craft, all kinds of ships. He described sailing ships and others that sounded almost like ships that use steam. They had some sort of usable power that was generated by these crystals that was used all over the main island, particularly around the few cities that they had. He talked about these really extensive gears, and frankly, in the last 2 years, archaeologists have uncovered more and more from the Chinese and from the Greeks about how incredible their technology really was. And they didn't know this until just a couple of years ago, and a lot of what Casey describes is real similar, where they had these incredible gears driven by water that could do just about anything. Casey talked about plumbing in the cities. He talked about canals, the movement of timber. Their technology appears to have been different, not like we'd think of maybe ancient technology or even 1800s technology, not quite what we have today, but different. They could do just about anything we could do ourselves today. They did not appear to have anything like we have in computers. He said they could send images through the air, and it sounded almost like...
like TV?
TV, and he talked about they were able to send voices through the air. He did have quite a few readings that discussed how they sent messages to some of these aircraft that moved fairly slowly, and that sounded almost like communication with light. Through this crystal, where this light would send out, where the crystal would send out a beam of light that had information in it, almost like laser communication of some kind. But that's kind of a synopsis. It was pretty advanced. I used to be really skeptical about this until they have now uncovered that the Chinese and the Greeks seem to have had the same kind of technology, minus the crystal, of course.
Well, I remember an old movie on Atlantis where the crystal was beamed to destroy any other nation.
Yep.
That, remember that movie?
Yep, that's straight out of Casey.
Yep.
It sure is, and that's the part of Atlantis that even the archaeologists that are interested in Atlantis don't like. And it's to them, it's fantastic and impossible, and I'm at the point where... I just want to know what the truth is.
Yep.
I'm not going to say anything's impossible. I just want to look around and see what's there, find the truth. But I don't think it's impossible anymore.
Do you think there's something down there that is affecting the so-called Bermuda Triangle, and that's why we have so many planes and boats disappearing, ships?
I do believe that there's something probably geologically different. There may be something else, too. Yes, that is possible. We've talked now to a lot of people that have had extremely strange experiences there around Bimini, around Andros, which is considered to be sort of the heart of the Bermuda Triangle. I think all the planes that have ever been lost are there. I think all the ships that have ever been lost are there.
You spotted a lot of them.
We have found some of the planes. There's no doubt about that. We've ID'd them with the N number on the tail. I got a feeling there's others there. We found other planes we haven't been able to quite visit yet, but we've got them from the air, and we're going to go see.
What kind of planes were they, Greg?
Well, the plane that we've ID'd for certain as one of the Bermuda Triangle originally disappeared in 1968 from Grand Turk, and we found it 500 miles away on near Red Bay at Andros, and we only found the tail of it.
Single engine?
It was a single-engine Cessna 172. There was radio communication. Two people were on it. As soon as it took off from Grand Turk, the pilot said he was low on fuel. And he's never heard from again. They never found a bit of wreckage, nothing. Now, this plane, we don't know when it came up on shore near at Red Bay's on Andros. It had to follow a long path in order to reach where we found
it. Sure.
But that's the tail. There's another one. We believe we found the Cessna 210 out on the bank. We're trying to ID with the help of the FAA some pieces and numbers that we got off of it, although we did not get the final number, which is called the N number. We walked to a crash DC-3 on Andros, which was very difficult to get to, and we used descendants of the Seminole Indians to get us out there. And we found a beach bonanza that we found the person who found it and dredged it up in 1989 at Morgan's Bluff. They looked in it, no bodies. They simply shoved it into a nearby jungle, and that's where it's been.
I was going to say, the skeletons are never found.
No, nothing in it. But it appears to have been, we got seven or eight serial numbers out of it. I actually have the plates here from it, from those serial numbers of parts and various other pieces in it. And we believe that's one that probably crashed into the tongue of the ocean, which is a very deep trench off of Andros. And there's two that it could be that disappeared in that area. That Cessna 210, we believe, is one that disappeared on the way from Androstown Airport to Fort Pierce. The question is why? There are some very strange winds that develop out there. We know about things like wind shear and so on, but there do appear to be almost like wind tunnels, almost like a mini jet stream. And if a plane flies into it, as far as the pilot knows, he's got the same airspeed, but ground speed could even be minus. A plane can move backwards in the air.
Oh, my. If
you know that, I assume.
Well, no, I never did.
Well, a plane.
I guess that's possible.
Well, it is. I'm a pilot.
I never thought of it like that.
A plane that goes, say, 140 miles an hour, if it's flying into a 170-mile-an-hour wind,
you're going backwards.
It will go backwards, which is why you don't fly into a 170-mile-an-hour wind.
Do you
stay in the air?
I was going to say, do you still stay up there? All right.
Sure you do, because your airspeed is still going to be 140.
Amazing. What's a turbulence like on something like that?
It depends. It can be horrendous. We've had some tremendous turbulence out there, but most of the time it's been very smooth. And we have flown. We fly very, very low sometimes. But to spot all these dark formations out there, we started at 5,000 feet, and they just started popping up. And there's hundreds more. We've only begun this. There's hundreds and hundreds of more things there. We just don't know what they all are.
Tell me what you think you know with all this.
Well, let me tell you one more thing we discovered. There is a wall we found north of Andros. I know this. We found this roughly 300-yard-long wall, 7 miles north of Andros. Interesting, it's the same distance as that marble temple. But it comes off of a small island, goes out into very shallow water. Most of it's sunk into the sand. It's three or four levels high above the sand. Some of it's been strewn around, but it's an enormous wall. Nobody knows where it came from. We've talked to Bahamians who are 80-year-old fishermen. They're like 80, 85 years old that have seen it before, but it was irrelevant to them. And we've tried to find out who built it, when they built it, and their answer is it's always been there. And there's no reason for it. It doesn't look like a retaining wall. It's incredibly shallow in there. It's hard to get to. Nobody's ever lived there. There's not any evidence of anybody wanting to live there. Yet there is this monstrous wall made of blocks that are 3, 4, 5, 6 foot square cubes sitting on top of each other, and it's really long. We don't know what it is. That island also has multicolored rocks on it. Black, white, and we found a number of red rocks, which makes no sense at all. So what do I think I know? I think I know for sure that the Bahamas had a maritime culture that mainstream archaeology is clueless about. I also believe there is now clear evidence that in 10,000 B.C., somebody was living along the 10,000 B.C. shoreline, 10 feet above it. There were stone buildings there. They weren't huge buildings, but you wouldn't build huge buildings right by the water's edge. You'd build tent buildings that tended to ships and other things. But there was something there. It extended probably down to Quetzal. Cuba remains the great unknown in this, and I believe Cuba probably holds the secret. And it's funny. As Andrew Collins says, Cuba is a blind spot. We don't think about it in archaeological terms at all, but it may well hold the big secret. Casey's readings discuss going to the west and south of Bimini, that he highly recommended that. And if you do that, you wind up at Andros and eventually Cuba. And I think that's probably where we're headed. I think we'll find a lot more Bermuda Triangle disappearing ships and planes. Exactly why they disappeared, I don't know, but they're there.
And you will stay there for how long, Greg?
Well, we're going to keep doing this as long as we can, which I guess that boils down to health and money, and so far both are holding.
Did Edgar Casey ever talk about the apocalypse, Armageddon?
I don't think he ever mentioned the word Armageddon in the readings. I might be wrong. He did talk about another coming of Christ. He did talk about cataclysms occurring. Of course, he talked about a possible pole shift. He talked about massive earthquakes, and Japan is supposed to disappear in the twinkle of an eye. He talked about West Coast earthquakes. He talked about the Gulf of Mexico actually moving up the Mississippi and occupying a great deal of the southern states. But all that's in what he called coming earth changes. But he said, too, that these things aren't necessarily going to occur. He said that if everything remains the same, this is what's going to transpire.
He was an amazing man.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. And he's still, as many people as love Edgar Casey, he's hated by skeptics just as much. It's amazing.
Even with that accuracy rate for the health readings, which are obviously verifiable?
They simply say he was guessing, or the people doing the research were wrong, even though the American Medical Association themselves have dubbed Edgar Casey the father of holistic health, because it all emerged in his health readings. It's amazing. But no, skeptics don't like it. Everything that Casey ever said was true about the ancient world, as far as they're concerned, was a lucky guess.
One of the things that he predicted that has not come to pass yet, and that's a good thing, is an incredible Earth Changes look on the United States. Areas that we know today would be gone.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the whole southern states from if you take where the Mississippi comes out near New Orleans, and you basically open the Mississippi up about 200 miles to the east and the west and take it all the way up to basically where I live in Memphis, Tennessee. It's like a massive lake down there, according to Casey, when the earth changes take place. A good deal of California is gone, according to Casey.
Did he ever talk about when?
He did say that the earth changes would begin approximately around 1998.
Okay.
That did not come to pass as
well. Maybe it did. I mean, just today.
I will agree with you. It's just I'm going to play the skeptic's role to a point and just simply say that he did have that year in those readings, and California didn't fall into the ocean, and Japan didn't disappear. The one thing that did seem to that really, I do believe Casey seemed to show some, was 9/11. He talked about New York being struck, and if you take everything that he said, it just fits really well.
He and Nostradamus were pretty close to a lot of things.
Yeah, I believe in Nostradamus, too. I know that you can interpret it a lot of ways, but so what? There's a lot of things you can interpret in a lot of ways.
Any revelations coming from any conferences or anything like that?
Well, we do have a conference coming up. The biggest revelation, I believe, first of all, the information we've got is, I still haven't processed all this. I was not able to get my film up on the underwater wall. It's pretty impressive. There's a lot of stuff there. It's going to blow people away. Andrew Collins will be at a conference with us in Virginia Beach, this coming October, around October the 4th. It's the ARE's Ancient Mysteries Conference, and Andrew has found some pretty incredible stuff about Cygnus, the constellation of Cygnus, genetics, and the Hall of Records in Egypt. It all seems to tie together rather nicely, and It seems like a couple hours ago I mentioned that he had found this well opening that leads into the Giza Plateau. And this is a real thing, and it fits the Cygnus constellation. You can overlay Cygnus there. I think both Cygnus and Orion are mimicked by the three great pyramids and the six little ones that are there. Those now appear to play a role. You know, they've been ignored, the so-called Queen's pyramids and the cult pyramids. There's six little ones on each side. But anyway, yeah, that stuff is all coming, and we think we got a really great conference. Andrew has great information on 2012. And again, that's October 4th, Virginia Beach.
2012 is so close now.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's amazing. It's coming up very fast. I do not think the world will end. I do not think that there'll be anything horrible that happens. But I can be wrong. I'm known to be wrong.
Well, it could be a huge celestial event. I think the Mayans, if they were from Atlantis, they knew something.
I think they knew something too. And I'll tell you, if nothing else, consciousness. If nothing happens, consciousness will still alter drastically during that celebration of 2012.
When you talk to skeptics about Edgar Cayce, and now that you've gone from one side to the other, what do you say to try to defend him?
You know, I talk about the health readings, and that's it. And I can talk to scientists like a scientist. I publish in scientific journals. I still do. I don't talk about that much when I'm on a radio show like this. But I'm still a scientist, and I simply talk about it in scientific terms, and I don't say I'm a true believer because I'm not. I go where the facts go. I really believe in that. I think that's the only thing we can do. But I also believe that I believe in the spirit. I believe that we are spiritual beings and there is a spiritual world. I think it's the only thing that makes sense. And that's all I tell them. There are very few that are directly hostile. The ones that are hostile are those who are anonymous, who attack from a distance, and those who I believe have already set themselves out as being totally diametrically opposed to Cayce and anything the Cayce organization stands for.
I think Cayce, through his trances, took a lot out of him. I think it killed him.
It did. We've had this discussion before. In the end, the readings told Edgar he should not give more than one a day. He was overloaded with bundles of mail every day. He did too many readings. The readings told him, this is going to kill you. You know, and skeptics even say, well, it proves he was fake because he didn't die. I'm not sure, did they expect him to live forever?
No.
I mean, that's insane. And if they'd ever read anything about Cayce, they would know the readings told him that if he didn't stop doing it this much, and he was guilty. He said, I've got to help these people. Here's somebody dying of this disease, and they're desperate for some sort of advice or help. So he did as many as he could do. The readings told him it was going to kill him, and it did.
I think so, too. Absolutely.
Yeah. In a way, it's a sad and tragic story, but it's a phenomenally wonderful
one. He saved so many lives, too.
Yes, he did.
What he did. Let's take phone calls when we come back, all right?
Okay.
We'll spend the entire hour. We'll take calls. How about a website, Greg? What's your favorite?
Well, the favorite one I'd like to give out is Cayce, www.Edgar, C-A-Y-C-E, is Cayce.org. And ours is a little hard to get to, but it's mysterious-america.net.
You got it. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.